You have known the topic this morning. Now it's up to you. Let's remember that Jesus was with his disciples on what we call the Mount of Ascension. They had seen him crucified. They had been so bruised and hurt and wondering in their hearts. They had rejoiced at the news of his resurrection. And then he had been with them on a number of occasions in the days following. Now they stood there on the mount from which he would ascend to heaven. And he said in his words, really what the topic says, I've been with you now for these 3 years. I've shared with you the love of God. I've tried to reveal to you my deep love for mankind, in particular the part of it that the rest of the world doesn't love. I've given you the message. I've promised you the power. Now it's up to you. Actually, he said it in the words of the Great Commission, you know. But I think they might have had a lot of conversation as they walked up the mountain and as they chatted. But then, not his dying words, but his glorious ascending words were, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded, and lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. And then slowly, up out of their sight, he went back to his Father. But as they left that mountaintop from which he had ascended, I'm sure they said over and over and over again, now it's up to us. Let's don't let him down. I do not remember if my cherished friend Charles Roselle was in college at the time Dr. S.D. Gordon came here in the summer times to student retreats. Mr. Roselle, he was an Englishman who had come at long last to live in Greensboro. Quiet man. He looked like a miniature Prince Albert. There was no amplification in the early days of our student retreats, and one had to listen very carefully. And when he wanted you to be sure you didn't miss what he was saying, he would say, are you listening now? And oh, we listened with ear and heart. He told this perfectly beautiful story, which has serenaded me with its inspiration through the years. It's an imaginative situation that when Jesus returned to heaven, all of the people closest to the throne thronged around him and said, oh, you suffered so much and you gave up your companionship with us here for so long. And they treated you so badly. Are you sure that what it cost you is going to pay off? Are you sure that what you tried to start is going to be perpetuated? Dr. Gordon pictured Jesus as smiling and saying, well, I shared my message with Peter and John's and James and the others. They're going to tell others, and they're going to tell others, and the others will tell others on down through till everybody hears. And then an anxious angel said, but Lord, what if your followers fail you? And Dr. Gordon smiled again, smiling the smile of Jesus, and had Jesus saying, if my followers fail me, I have absolutely no other plan. And that is so true, student friend. He has committed the sharing of the gospel with his followers, and if we fail him, he doesn't have any other plan. And now not only is the sharing of that gospel up to you, but the sharing of the inspiration you've had here at Ridgecrest is up to you. The disciples were never the same again after they came down out of that mountain. No trip was too hard or long to take. No load was too difficult for them to shoulder and carry. No suffering was too great for them to endure. No sacrifice was too great for them to be called upon to make. They just remembered who he was, what he had done, how he had taught, and how much he was counting on them. They were just never the same again. We shouldn't ever be the same again after these wonderful days here. I really mean it. We shouldn't ever be the same again. I just have the feeling that in living and loving and serving and witnessing and sacrificing, we ought never to be the same again. But I want to point out 4 ways in which I hope we will be different now that we realize it's really up to you and me. In the first place, I hope we will be better Christians in our daily living from this moment forward than we've ever been before. The sheer joy of living his teachings and the sheer joy of seeing that other people become more interested in what it is that makes us that way than they were in the past. Milt Hughes shared with me the result of one of the polls taken here among our students. Several things listed about the greatest concerns of Southern Baptists, and you thought that the most urgent need, according to the way you voted, was that more of us translate the gospel into our daily living than ever before. Well, bless you, really, for feeling that that's the greatest need, and it is the greatest need. But now, it could begin with you and me, and it ought to begin with you and me. Has my thinking really been the thinking the mind of Christ would be thinking? Has my emotional pattern been self-centered or as much other person-centered as it ought to be? Has my tongue been a Christian tongue? Has my body been truly the temple of the Holy Spirit? Have I really been translating the teachings of Jesus into my daily living? Oh, when we remember how much He paid to be here to make possible those teachings, well, it ought to make a lot of difference in our thinking and in our resolution to live His teachings better than ever. There comes to us this meaningful story out of the past. It occurred on the campus of one of the distinguished old men's colleges in the East. There was a student named Tom who, though he was just delightful and normal, somehow or other had something that held him back from any compromise that the rest of the students didn't seem to have. He was a marvelous football player, but he'd never been known to break a training rule. And, of course, all the students griped about the other rules, but he never broke a rule of the college in which he was enrolled. He was so down to earth, so loving and so lovable, that he was everybody's love. And fellows would say to Tom's roommate, "Well, is he that way all the time?" And his roommate said, "Yes, he is. I don't know what makes him that way, but he's just a wonderful guy all the time. Somehow or other, wrong just doesn't seem to enter his mind. Doesn't seem to appeal to him at all." Commencement time and graduation now approached, and Tom and his roommate of 4 years were walking on an old trail to the rear of the campus. Finally, the roommate said, "Tom, I want to ask you a question, which is the question of every fellow who's known you in these 4 years. What is it that keeps you straight when the rest of us somewhere along the line always seem to break the rules and get off the reservation?" Tom leaned over against the old stone wall and said, "I really don't mind telling you, but it's so personal, so precious, so sacred. I want to be sure that anybody who hears will understand and appreciate it." And then as his roommate listened, Tom said, "24 years ago, a wonderful New England boy and a lovely New England girl, knowing they were in love, married. And in the third year of their marriage, they were looking for the coming of their first little one. They lived in a small community. There was only a modest hospital there, not a separate maternity section. Now the time for the birth of the little one had arrived, and the eager husband took his wife to the hospital, and he paced in the hallway outside, and after a while he noticed that unusual equipment was being wheeled into her room, and that other doctors were going in, and became deeply agitated, and presently her doctor came out and signaled the anxious young husband aside and said, 'I cannot explain it to you now, sir, it is so involved. But here's the situation. We cannot save both lives. If the little child is to be born alive, you're going to have to do some things that will make it almost impossible for your wife's life to be saved. If we are to save her life, we're going to have to do some things that will make it almost imperative that the child be born not alive. And I, as the doctor, should not be called upon to make that decision. I'll ask you to make it.'" And though he had shushed the agitated young husband into silence, in that traumatic moment, the husband practically shouted, "I demand that you save the life of my wife. I don't know what the little one would be, but I know she's the most wonderful person in the world. I demand it, I demand it." And they heard a quiet voice from the room, the voice of a suffering would-be mother. They both rushed in. The doctor standing here, the agitated young husband there. The suffering woman looked up into the face of her husband and said, "Dear, they didn't tell me, but I knew all the time we couldn't both live. And oh, I love you to the last breath in my body for what you said out there. Then she turned to the doctor and said, but doctor, I am the one whose life is at stake. I have the right to say. And then with the courage of which only a great Christian woman is capable, she looked at the doctor and said, doctor, I demand it. The baby must be born alive. Well, Tom Jr., telling his buddy the story, shifted from foot to foot and swallowed hard and said, I was the little baby born that night. My father moved to the West when I was an infant. There was nobody there who knew the background. Often I would say to my dad, who never remarried, Daddy, why don't I have a mother the way the other little boys do? And Dad would say with a faraway look in his eyes, you did have a mother, wonderful, wonderful mother, son. But she died when you were quite young. When I was old enough to appreciate travel, he would take me back once every few years to the East End. As I look back upon it, I recognize that he always went through that little village at twilight. And I realized later that it was that he didn't want anybody to be in the cemetery when we went in. He'd lay beautiful flowers on my mother's grave and tell me something new every time. Then on the night before I came to college and met you as my roommate, he took me, having brought me back from the West, to enter his college through the cemetery. He was very much agitated. And finally, after he had put the flowers, he stood in front of me and grabbed my shoulders and looked into my eyes with burning fire and said, you've asked me all your life, Tom Jr., why you don't have a mother. And now I'm going to tell you. And that night before I came to college, my daddy told me what I've just told you. And then my daddy said to me, son, if you go to college and do anything beneath the level of an honorable Christian gentleman, you will be desecrating the memory of a woman who chose to die that you might be born and grow up and come to college. And then Tom, smiling through his tears, said to his roommate, you see, I never had the right to be wrong. Oh, the Lord Jesus would have done what he did for just you or me. Had you or I been the only person in the world lost in sin, he would have come just as gladly to die for you or me. Paul caught that concept so wonderfully. He said, you are not your own. You've been bought with a price. And so, student friend, I hope you'll go away from here saying, because of what he did for me on the cross, what he has done for me in all these years, I want to translate his teachings into my daily living better than I have ever done before. I hope that's one difference that will come into our lives. That we are going to be more Christ-like in our daily living. And that'll make us a lot happier, make us a lot more attractive to other people. Secondly, I hope that we'll go away from here with a greater caring for our world than we've ever had before. And that's been so beautifully presented this week, really, in just a half dozen ways of which you're familiar. I hope we will have a greater sense of caring than we've ever had before. His kind of caring. You know, Ken Miedema was at a statewide youth rally in 77 in the Coliseum in Jackson, Mississippi. And so often in his presentation there, he had as a sort of refrain, who are the people Jesus would be spending some time with and looking after if he came back? And he mentioned the rejected people, the people who had been passed by, the sinful people. And I loved his expression. He said he'd spent a lot of time with the tacky people. I want us to have his kind of caring. Who couldn't care for attractive people? Who couldn't care for those, so to speak, who have plenty to eat and plenty to wear and a car to drive and a girl or a boy to love? And I hope we'll have more of his kind of caring from here on out. I hope we'll care more than we ever have for the incorrigible students on campus whose conduct just makes them positive stinkers. Instinctively, we want to put a clothespin of rejection on our noses and turn away, but Jesus didn't. the woman at the well outside of Sychar, married five times, then living with a man who was not her husband, rejected by the church and rejected by society. But Jesus cared enough to take his lunch period to talk to her and to win her to the love of God. The woman caught in adultery. Ooh, I hope nobody sees me talking to her. Ooh, they might think I'm that sort. A lot of present-day Christians would say, but not Jesus. He cared so much that he lifted her up, if I may use an old figure, out of the miry pit of sin in which she was. And she became a devout follower. Zacchaeus, cheating skinflint, whom everybody despised, except Jesus. He cared. And there's students like that on your campus. There always were on mine, even though it is a church-related college. The cussinest and the swearinest and the dirtiest joke teller on my campus, I remember, seemed to be just incorrigible. But enough students kept on loving him, even when, figuratively speaking, he spat in their faces. That after I left the college and came into my work and encountered him, I couldn't believe he was the same person. He was completely transformed. Some students just your age cared enough to keep on loving that incorrigible boy. The ones who are impossible in their attitudes, they just bug you so. They are smart aleck. They know better than everybody else in the world, and stupid you. How do you think you can think as well as I can? Have you ever met a student like that on your campus? I had to deal with students. I remember one boy. It was one of the three most brilliant students who ever came to the college while I was there. Felt the president was a stupid odd pod who ought to get out of the chair and let him, this sophomore student, run the college. His attitude toward the dietitian was, why did you ever come out of the ark in the first place? His attitude toward the librarian, who was a lady, was, you old fossil, who are you to tell me that I can't have my way in the library? His attitude toward me as dean of men was, you whippersnapper, whoever endowed you with omniscience to tell us all how to behave? Oh, I had the hardest time practicing Christian love toward him that I ever did. You see, I directed all the student activities, and he was trying to put a cog in the wheel day by day by day. We had 4 weeks of emphasis in the church on tithing as a Christian privilege. He, by hook or crook, or both, had got himself chosen to be director of the training unions, of which we had 13. Nothing that ever came from Nashville was worthy of the college mind, he said. So he wrote the training union programs. And there were 4 Sunday night programs on the subject. Tithing is neither biblical nor Christian, so please don't do it. He was a bumblebee in my bonnet, a sandspur in my shoe. He was an irritation by day, and if I dreamed of it at night, he was a nightmare by night. I find myself saying, oh, Lord, let him get a scholarship somewhere else. I would have been glad to call out the band and drive him to the other place, really. Until it dawned on me, Jesus would have cared for that boy. And I began to care for him and learn why he had come to be that way. And he came to be one of the most devoted friends I've ever had. The impossible student who seems impossible in his attitude, and the improbable student who seems to be really such a simple person who won't amount to anything. And well, Peter would have been passed by. He was an ignorant, unlearned, cursing, swearing fisherman that the church of his day had never taken any interest in. But in this, if you please, improbable person, Jesus found the great preacher of Pentecost. Or to say it differently, as we go back with more of Jesus' kind of caring, let's care for the sinful ones as we've never cared before. Let's care for the snobbish ones who really look down upon us as being simple enough, you know, to be enthusiastic about the Christian way of life. The sneering ones who wonder why in the world intelligent college students could be devoted to a musty old book that was written so far back in the past? And why in the world do you go through with the superstition of praying? The sneering ones. And I say again, the small people who may be just perfectly wonderful diamonds in the rough. I taught, of course, upper-class English, but my big job was freshman English. Three levels of it, 100 for the students who had no preparation, 101 for those who were moderately prepared, 102 for those who were well prepared. This boy came into my 100 section. In the early 1930s, there were the poorest high schools in Mississippi, I suppose, of anywhere in the nation. No cars, no roads. Had to be little high schools within walking nearness. 50 students in a high school, two teachers teaching all 16 subjects. I received students who really needed fifth grade English. This boy was one of them. Of course, he flunked 16 out of the 16 themes he needed to write in the first semester. Flunked the semester exam, but came by my office to tell me that it looked as if he hadn't learned very much, but it helped him out a great deal. And he was going to try again. And he did. He almost passed the second time he tried. And the third time he made it. Well, bless his wonderful heart. Do you know he became eventually a pastor with a Ph.D. from our Southern Seminary? And has done one of the finest ministries that I know. Ministered so long in a college church which was adjacent to a college campus. So a lot of the people who don't seem to be very promising may be just diamonds in the rough. So let's go away from here with more caring than we've ever gone before. About other people and about world hunger and about the sick and the rejected and the lonely and the sinful and the ignorant and, well, all the people round about us who need the touch of His love. Thirdly, I hope we will go away from here with the resolutions to witness and serve better than we've ever done before. You remember between His resurrection and His ascension, Jesus had that wonderful conversation with Peter. Peter, do you love me? Well, Lord, you know I do. Three times he asked that question, and three times Peter replied in the affirmative, and three times Jesus said, either feed my lambs or feed my sheep, look after my sheep. Suppose Peter had said, Lord, what do you mean? Feed my sheep. I wouldn't presume to know the wonderful words Jesus would have said, but I think they would have amounted to this. Peter, all the people in the world are sheep. Some of them are lost sheep. And they need to be brought to the Savior shepherd by people like you who know me. And Peter, every time I look down upon you and see that you're trying to witness to a person who doesn't know me, Peter, that will tell me more than 10,000 words that you love me. Then Peter, some of the sheep are little lambs. They need tender guidance, good examples from Christians like you. And when I see you tailoring your life that it become a magnetic force and not a repelling force, a stepping stone and not a stumbling block. Oh, Peter, that will tell me that you love me. Then, Peter, some of the sheep are sick and some are hungry and some are cold and some are rejected. Some are so grief-stricken and in despair. Peter, every time I see you taking the time to minister to the deep needs of people round about you, in my name and in my spirit and for my sake, Peter, that will tell me more than 10 volumes that you love me. Have you ever tried to tell somebody about Jesus? What a shame if you haven't. Exactly 30 years ago, in what we then called the student retreat, in the final message then, as I'm having the privilege of doing now, I said, your average age is 19. You've been 10 years a Christian. Have you ever told anybody about Jesus? I said, you'll surely never learn any younger. I said, why don't you go home, talk with your pastor about it, or marvel a Sunday school teacher, and maybe get a group together who could be coached in the matter of approaches. And there are plenty of books on soul winning. I'm not going to ask it this morning, but I did then. How many of you, I said 30 years ago, will make this commitment? With God's help, I'm going to try to win one person to Christ. Each month, we were meeting them the first week in June. June, July, August. A very great group stood, and many wrote me at the end of the summer. But the most thrilling letter I had was from a Furman University boy who had returned for his junior year. He said, "Doc Swar, stood that morning but shaking in my shoes, for I'm a very timid person. I don't really feel comfortable talking to anybody about anything." But I was 19, and I'd been 10 years a Christian. And you persuaded me that it wasn't right to have known Jesus for 10 years without introducing him to somebody else. I went back and talked to my pastor. He encouraged me so much, gave me a book to read, and then gave me a list of people who were not Christians. And he said, "Oh, Dr. Swar, I want to tell you about my thrilling summer. I talked to 30 people in June, July, and August who are not Christians. First time I went, my mouth went dry, my tongue went stiff. But when I opened my mouth to speak, the power came. I talked to 30 people who were not Christians. 12 of them have already accepted Jesus and have been baptized into church membership. Graduated from Furman, went out to San Diego for his training, wrote me, 'I'm so glad I learned to witness. There are hundreds around me who need to know Jesus.' Served his time in the Pacific, and then when he came out of the Pacific, instead of coming back to join his affluent father in the family business, he stayed for several years in Honolulu to teach in our Baptist Academy because 46% of the people in Honolulu are of pagan backgrounds. And there was such a marvelous opportunity to witness. And it began right here at Ridgecrest in the final service of a student conference 30 years ago. Oh, I wish it could begin with you today. I'm going to witness." Well, let me just make this suggestion. Suppose your resolution should be this. Beginning with this year, God being my helper, and he will be, I'm going to win one person to Christ each year, as long as I live. And I'm going to commit everybody I win to winning one person a year as long as he or she lives. And ask them to commit all the ones and tell them to commit all the ones down the way. You know what that would turn out to be in 25 years? And unless some tragedy takes you away, you're going to be here more than 25 years. At the end of this year, just be you and one other person. And then 4 and 8 and 16 and 32 and 64 and 128. I sat down with pencil and pen, and do you know what I found would occur in 25 years? Beginning with you, and following that sequence, winning one person to Christ each year, making those commitments, 33 million people would have been won to Christ because you made that resolution. Now remember, Jesus said in the scene he was picturing at the end of the ages, "I was hungry and you gave me meat. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in, naked and you clothed me, sick and you visited me, in prison and you came to me." And those people will say, "Lord, whenever did we see thee in those conditions of need and minister unto you?" And you remember his wonderful words, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me." For Jesus' sake, let's not only witness, but let's serve better than we've ever done before. And finally, in addition to going away from here, realizing he's counting on us, it's up to us. Let's resolve to be better Christians in daily living. Let's resolve to do more caring than we've ever done before. Let's resolve to do more witnessing and serving. But in the final moment, let's go away from here with a readier willingness to sacrifice than we've ever had before. How much it cost him to make our being here possible. Why should you and I want it to be comfortable and convenient, popular and profitable? And regardless of what it costs for you and me to be what he wants us to be, to do what he wants us to do, let's go away from here with a readier willingness to sacrifice than we've ever gone before. And with this illustration, I'm going to conclude. Archibald Rutledge, now deceased, great South Carolinian, was always one of my favorite writers. He lived in the ancestral Rutledge estate in the Pinelands of South Carolina. I think this is the most pungent and piquant thing he ever wrote, though it was a small writing. He went from the Rutledge estate one day into the nearby city over a country road, on both sides of which were great pine forests, into which the workers had gone to extract turpentine from the pine trees. To his right, as he drove, he saw a thing he'd seen often. On a little bramble bush, there was a coat hanging, there was a lunch pail hanging, and there was a little dog there barking at all passers-by, and he knew what had occurred. The simple turpentine worker had left his coat, his pail, and his dog, and he said to his dog, "You stay here, look after this till I get back." The dog may not have understood the English, but he understood the assignment. And he was barking. Dr. Rutledge was in the city several hours. When he turned his car homeward, he saw billowing clouds of black smoke, and oh, he knew what had occurred. There were these brown pine needles all over the roadsides, and he knew some careless motorist had flicked out a cigarette or a match, and the pine needles had become inflamed, and the fire had raced along, burning everything black. When he passed back by the point at which earlier he'd seen the bush, the coat, the pail, the dog, the fire had come, had burned everything black, and had gone on its way. The bush was burned to a stub. The coat was burned to ashes. The luncheon pail was almost melted, and the lunch within it was as black as carbon. But to Dr. Rutledge's amazement, lying dead at the stub of that bush was the body of that dog. Why that dog wouldn't have run, we shall never understand on this earth. For self-preservation is the great, great law of animal life. But by the way, in my journeys, I read of at least a half dozen acts of heroism on the part of dogs every year. I don't know why they do it for the ones they love, but they do. Dr. Rutledge stopped his car, walked out alongside, took off his hat, for very really he stood in the presence of an act of heroism. As he stood there, he heard the sound of running feet. This simple turpentine worker was working on the other side of the forest and had just recently heard the news of the fire. I'm going to quote what the worker said. I'm using his language, but oh, you know me by now well enough to know that I am not deprecating the fact that he couldn't talk very well. He was using the best words he had. And as he rushed out, when he saw what had occurred, he emitted a sob from way down deep inside, and in an attempt to alleviate the sadness, Dr. Rutledge said, "You're too late. Your lunch is burned up." The simple turpentine worker said, "Oh, mister, I wasn't running from lunch. I was running from a dog." Then Dr. Rutledge said, with as beautiful pathos as he ever saw in a human face, the simple worker looked at him, hoping Dr. Rutledge would understand the immensity of his loss. And he said, "Mister, he's the most dependable dog I ever had. You know, mister, I had to be careful what I told that dog to do. Because once I'd done told him, I sure knowed he'd do it. Isn't that beautiful? I had to be careful what I told that dog to do. Because once I'd done told him, I sure knowed he'd do it." We have an infinitely more wonderful master who told us just before he ascended what he wanted us to do. And we, with minds in the likeness of God and with immortal spirits and with an infinite and incomparable Savior, ought to take seriously what he asked us to do just before he ascended to heaven. Now, it's up to you to live with a difference, to care with a difference, to witness and serve with a difference, and to sacrifice gladly if need be.